manufacture for us, because what we say is in them is in them, because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour two, we're 10 minutes in, and as mentioned, with Joe, and having to, you know, to do this will be tough, I think, for everybody that comes up. You know, go back about, I guess it's a little after the beginning of the year, and Alan Dickinson started to inform, you know, basically all of his friends and all of us that, you know, followed him on social media, that he was facing a health crisis, and it was there for us, you know, to follow and to root for him and send him good messages, and it broke badly, and everybody knew that this was coming, but it doesn't make it, you know, not even an ounce easier. Paul Matisse joins us first to pay tribute to Dink, and I only got to know him at all because of Paul and Duke. Paul, and I'm going to say the same thing to everybody, I'm so sorry, and know how much fun and you know what a, you know, what a fascinating character he was, and incredibly generous. You know, tell everybody about Dink as you knew him.
Yeah, he was a great character, but you know, he was, when he got sick, you know, Dinky had so much heart as a gambler that I just kept hoping that he would fight through it all, you know. So even though we knew it was coming, it's still you know, hard to believe and sad.
It was remarkable, actually, after it became clear that, you know, the there wasn't going to be a happy ending, or, you know, a delay in you know, in the illness taking, you know, taking its toll. But he did get to have this, what I thought seemed heroic, you know, last whatever it's been, 6-8 weeks, where he just willed himself to, you know, kind of the opportunity to say goodbye to so many friends.
Yeah, Dinky was so honest. He's like, you know, a little like me. We're honest to a fault sometimes. So he's very transparent about everything in his life. But he was always that way. You know, I think that was Dink, you know. And that's why everybody, I think, was drawn to him. And then you knew what you were getting with Dink. You know, and like you said, I'm more just looking to all the fun, you know. I mean, one of the things that I've tried to do in the race, and my family tried to do, and my friends, is that it's serious. It's a serious game and everything, but we still try to have fun. That's first. And Dinky was definitely out of that mold. You know, he got that, and that's why he loved Saratoga, and he loved being with the, you know, when everybody would come out to the races, because, you know, that the fun came first, even though, you know, he was very serious, and, you know, he'd like to downplay it, but I think he was a great handicapper. You know, he was a great handicapper, and he would always premise it with that he's not very good and all this, but, you know, he never fooled me, and I'm sure he didn't fool anybody else either. He was, you know, he was a talented guy, and a very, you know, a great thinker. So you would, as you would expect, he'd be a great horse player.
When did you guys meet?
Well, you know, a lot of things happened in out in Las Vegas when at the boardwalk when the rebates happened originally in Vegas, And all the horse players, it was like a convention back in the mid-90s when you had heard of all these horse players and they all just kind of showed up at the boardwalk at some point. So you got to meet everybody. You know, in the past, you only knew stories of all these characters. And then all of a sudden, they were all in the same building, you know, every day. You know, and similar to Saratoga, you know, that place was fun too, you know, for the same reasons that I said. And I, you know, a lot of us, some people didn't get it. It was too, you know, it was too much fun for some people and they didn't hang out. But that, like I said, Dinky was, we were going to be drawn to Dinky right away. You know, I mean, that's, we were, you know, very similar in the way we went about gambling and, you know, the way we did things. So he became part of our group, you know, pretty just, I wouldn't say immediately, but, you know, quite a bit. But he was always into sports too, and he had all the runners and that was interesting. So everybody was asking, you know, would always ask him. He'd have a million different runners. And, you know, one of the things about Dink that was so great is that, you know, In his business, you have people who make bets for you and runners, and you know they come and go. But Dinky would have these runners that would become like his family. You know, they would work for him for a semester in college, and they would come visit him every year at Saratoga. And you know that says something about a person when you know that the people that were just working for you, like on a part-time job, became part of your family. You know, it was. He was pretty unique in that.
He's New York born and raised and Queens and kind of comes out of that Flamingo Kid scenes and essentially at Roosevelt.
Yeah, you know, he was a regular at the harness tracks when he first started, but. But he was kind of like me, that he was drawn to all the different gambling games, you know. As you know, he made the finals of final table at the World Series of Poker. It might not have been the same year, but it was very close to the same year he was like a few positions from making the finals at the Horse Players final table, which is great, you know, and, that year, I remember, it's the last year I went to the NHC because of all this pandemic stuff. And you know how they put those arrows in the contests, you know, like who's hot and who's not? Dinky might have the record. He went from like 390th to 20th, like in about 8 minutes. And it was unbelievable how many winners he had in a row after not having any winners. But that's just how tough he was. He never thought he had no chance, even though he wasn't doing any good. You know, he might complain, he might whine, but you could tell that he hadn't given up. You know, and that's that was Dink.
He, you know, the backstory. I mean, because I knew who he was, as you reference, you know, one of those names that you hear, and of course, as I've discussed before, one of those names that you heard, you know, kind of growing up around the game and becoming serious about the game, one of those other names you heard was the Matisses. So it had that same mystique, and of course the movie. We're going to talk to Beth Raymer, who wrote Lay the Favorite, and was his assistant. But I mean, he made book. He did all the rough and tumble kinds of things that you would expect, actually.
Yeah, but you know what? It wasn't about the, you know, I mean, I guess everybody else looks at it maybe as glamour, but he. You know, took the detail and he took it serious, you know, and that's why I think everybody, that's why the legend of him kind of grew, you know, because he just went about it his own way. He didn't follow any blueprint or anything, but, and like I said before, he was, you just could never figure him out completely, but you knew he was going to be honest and he knew he was going to pay attention to details, you know. I think Beth, you know, just nailed that with the book, Lay the Favorite. You know, like, you had to say lay the favorite. You couldn't say take the favorite because it was so against his, you know, his lexicon, and it was just so against his mind that he would pound that into Beth's head, you know, and all of his other runners that he had too as well. So it, you know, he's going to be like you said, he was one of a kind, and he's definitely going to be missed.
Yeah, he raised a lot of money for charity. You know, he had the in recent years.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, that you know, he did an incredible job with, you know, just all on his own. I mean, he did that by himself. You know, the Dink Fund and using his talents to create money. That innovation is just, I mean, that's so, you know, what I was drawn to Dinky about, because it's, you know, that's him, and that's, you know, I love stuff like that. That he would somehow find a way to use gambling as, you know, for the good, you know, and to do it in the way that he does it, you know. I mean, that he could do it, you know. That's so perfect. It's so Dink. It's just so perfect for me too. I just love things like that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I wrote that down too. I wanted to make sure that people realized how much money he raised for the horses, and you know, anybody who knows him knows that he was an animal lover, you know. So it's not surprising, but it kind of went unsung. You know, you don't hear much about it, especially in the industry. And, you know, he was a great champion for that.
Now, and the Southern California Rescue, Southern California Thoroughbred Rescue is the charity, and I'm sure Beth will have thoughts as well, but one of the things I saw specifically was Southern California Thoroughbred Rescue, and I'll get that information if people want to donate in Dink's memory. Paul, I appreciate it. I appreciate you putting Beth in contact with me. David Goodfriend, the Maven's going to join us as well. And, of course, David, you know, with a stint. So many people had this exodus to Vegas, right? I mean, he obviously did it you know, probably 30 years ago. There's so many that David did as well. And the Davidowitz ended up in Vegas. I mean, you know, so many that was certainly like a lifestyle choice, you know, kind of carved out of a certain era.
Yeah, well, the gamblers of my generation, we were kind of, you know, it was always a draw in the back of your head, probably, and then when it became either a necessity or valuable, you know, almost everybody went. And, you know, it was the time of our lives, you know, for a lot of us. So, you know, I have a lot of memories of, you know, great memories of Vegas and great memories of Dink and great memories of him since Vegas, too. So it was, you know, he's gone, but he'll be part of my life forever.
Paul Matisse, everybody. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Paul Matisse, first of our conversations about Alan Dinkinson, and Dave Goodfriend will be next. Beth Raymer, as mentioned, his assistant and the writer of Lay the Favorite, which of course became a film, and Bruce Willis starring as as Dink. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be a certain unique pleasure and thrill, you know, to have a life that is film worthy to begin with, and then let alone to put Bruce Willis in the title role. Jason Beam's going to join us as well, and you know, what's one thing that I've noticed here, and it's less than, you know, it's basically 24 hours at this point, I guess. All the different venues, the people are putting up the pictures. Kevin Kirstein put up a picture with Dink, and wrestling related, and you know, backyard pictures at Saratoga, and pictures from, my pictures will be from the ballroom at Treasure Island and then at Bally's when he sat in on the show. I'm sure that'll be the picture I'll put up. I've got a great picture of him and Duke, actually. So all these different walks of player life, essentially. I think we might have David ready. David? No? Not yet, Case? All right, we'll get... Yeah, we got Dave now. There we go. Dave, a good friend, joins us, and as mentioned, Dave had his stint in Vegas, and like Paul Matisse and so many others, one of the elite gamblers of the generation. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Steve. It's just a sad day. A giant in the world of gambling has been lost too soon, two nights ago, and a real shame. The man loved life, and I think that's the thing I'll remember about him most.
I'll let you start the same way, and you can just riff on all the different, you know, parts of his personality and your dealings. When did you first, you know, when did you guys first cross paths?
Same time Paul did, in the boardwalk days, in the late 90s.
Yep.
But I can't say that I knew him very well. I've always been, you know, like the Matisse clan, if you will, has always operated as a group, and I've been pretty much a lone wolf. And, you know, and over the years, I knew a lot of the same people that Dink did. I came across one of Gail's good friends who was surprised that Dink and I weren't good buddies with all the time that I spent in Vegas. And then I started going to Vegas more, you know, 2012, 2013 for poker, and our paths crossed, you know, sometime in the middle of the decade, and we started hanging out a bit and for fun things. And I was blessed at the Breeders' Cup 2016 when I had a top 10 finish to be hanging out with him, and my dad was there, and he got to meet my father, and I was real happy about that. But I got to do a lot of fun things with Alan, some of the non-gambling things. Got to see Joy Formidable with him. Got to go see a PWG wrestling in Reseda at the American Legion Hall. Got to see Quintessential Pro Wrestling with Dink, which is something that he hosted and promoted and basically funded out of his own pocket. He loved those wrestlers. He loved being part of the wrestling scene. And, you know, being with Dink at a small wrestling card like that was like being with royalty. You know, I went out to dinner with him one night with Dave Metzler, the noted wrestling maven, if you will, a real maven, if you will, when it comes to wrestling, with Shayna Baszler and Jessamyn Duke. And it was just amazing meeting those folks through Dink. And he just lived such a amazing, fun life. You know, the world needs more people like Dink, and what a character, what a guy, and I'm really glad that you and Paul talked about the rescue of the horses. He loved Hazel, his dog, and one thing I definitely want us just a huge shout-out to his ex-wife, Gail, who's been there for him throughout this ordeal, and she was just the champion for Dink at the end of his life, and just Gail was just phenomenal, and Dink was so blessed to have her along because he really didn't have a lot of family at the end.
What, from your perspective, and Paul pointed out the interesting and aspect, you know, of his ability to move from sport to sport, and you know, betting opportunity, you know, they were interchangeable basically in his, you know, wheelhouse. What made him so effective, from your observation, David?
Flexibility and being able to change with the times. You know, what works today in the world of gambling isn't what worked 5 years ago, or what worked 10, 15 years ago isn't going to be what works now. And he was always up to speed with the analytics and statistics of the day. It was fascinating at, you know, our dinners at Pasta Mia or Amores in Vegas to hear him, you know, how he would analyze going through betting hockey. And it made me watch the sport differently. And, you know, he was a slave to the numbers without question, but he made those numbers work for him, and he made a heck of a life by knowing when to, you know, go with the numbers, when the numbers were telling the truth and when the numbers weren't necessarily telling a full story.
I don't have enough breadth of knowledge in terms of his approach, and Beth will probably, you know, touch on this, and Jason Beam too, but it sure felt like he found niche opportunities and you know, kind of zero, could really bore down and find, you know, find vulnerabilities or areas to exploit.
Yeah, like, if, you know, in the hockey market, you know, sometimes there'd be trends that were going on, and you just, you ride the trend as long as you can, and until the market catches up with you, you go with it. That's what he saw his job as, and he was damn blanking good at it. Very good at it. And, he was a legend, and he was such a character, and he had such a good heart, and just, you know, all people. And one thing I want to add about Alan, to a number of people in the business, and Jason Beam could be given perhaps as an example, to somebody like Candace Hare, to Emily Gullickson, Alan was a mentor. He was somebody that young people coming up in the world of gambling, wanting to make it in the world of gambling, could look to for advice. He was very giving of his time, and he was very giving of his knowledge, and he really, you know, If he thought you were a good person, he'd go out of his way to help you, and he helped so many people in the world of gambling in a positive way. You know, so many people, and sometimes even me, could be construed at looking at gambling negatively, in life negatively. Alan had none of that in him. He was such a positive person, and I'll repeat myself again. The world needs more people like Dink. He was such a good example for people in the world of gambling. Be more like Dink, and I'm going to try to be more like Dink for the rest of my life.
David, good friend, everybody. And, David, I appreciate it, and hope we get to see you sooner than later, all right?
I'll be around, thankfully, you know. Alan, what happened with Alan is a great example, sadly, of how life is really short. He was only 69 years old. This came up suddenly. I mean, if you would have asked him a year ago or looked at his life a year ago and said, you know, that he wasn't going to be here now, it's frightening. And if there is a lesson to be taken from it, especially for old guys like myself in their 60s, live while you can, because we ain't going to be here all that long.
Well put. And be more like Dink. That's going to have to be we're going to have to make that a catchphrase.
Make that a hashtag.
Or, exactly.
Get that trending.
Exactly right. Whenever. Well, exactly. It could be a good horse name, too. I like it. More like Dink.
The Matisse stable. Let's make it happen.
I have got plenty of confidence that they would pick up that mantle. Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks for thinking of me, and there's a lot of people out there that were closer to Dink than I was, and to them and Gail, my heart is with you.
As always, poignant, and the Maven. The Maven hits it out of the park over and over again. We're going to stay here and get two more visits in before Sean Clancy joins us. And Beth Raymer, that whose name you know from having written Lay the Favorite. I think I said Let It Ride earlier, but Lay the Favorite. And not that Let It Ride isn't great, but it was Lay the Favorite that she made happen. And you know, being an assistant to Alan like she was exposed to, you know, all of the roller coaster elements that go into the story. And you know what, I'm anxious to ask Beth this, because whenever I would see him, and you know, over the last, I'm going to go back to whenever I first started going to Vegas, so it's a fairly lengthy period, and then he would come to Saratoga every summer and hang out at you know, the purple tablecloth crowd, the Matisse umbrellas, and he was just placid. When you think of, you know, big time gamblers and you know, the boisterous and volatility that comes with, you know, with being a player or a gambler of any ilk, and that he was just placid every time you'd see him, and even keeled, and I imagine there were moments of frustration, but there's a lesson there. I'm gonna think that you can't get, you know, too excited about the wins, and you can't get too upset about the losses, and you just stayed focused. Beth Raymer joins us, and Beth, you know, first and foremost, just speaking for horse players and anybody, any kind of gambler that knew who Alan was and what he represented, our deepest sympathies. Beth.
Hi.
Beth, hi. Appreciate you joining us, and just so sorry about this, and we kind of knew it was coming, but it doesn't make it easier.
Right. That's true.
Right?
I just heard what you were saying, just listening, when you talked about that Dink was so even keeled and placid, and he wasn't. You know, I think this is what was so amazing about Dink, that even though he gambled his entire life from the time that he was 15, 16 years old when he ran the pool at Stuyvesant High School, the baseball pool, every game meant so much to him. He never lost the passion of, you know, when he would lose a game. I mean, I saw him, he threw computers at walls. He would, like, you know, everything meant so much. He would pull, I watched him sit in a chair and pull his own hair out many, many times. So I think that's where, you know, he never, like, matured emotionally into his profession. He was always kind of, I don't want to say hysterical, but the games meant a lot to him.
Oh, this is funny, because I mean, other than you know, the watching racing and horseplay, haven't, you know, I just never saw that. I only saw him, you know, it was always so, you know, so placid. I mean, that's the way I was exposed to him. That's fun.
That's so funny. I mean, maybe he was like that at the horse track, but I remember leaving the horse track many times because he would get score updates on his little beeper that he carried around, and we would just have to leave the track immediately and get in the car where he could just, like, lose his shit in private.
So maybe that's what it was. It was yeah. Selective.
Yes, I think
how
so.
How did you, Beth? How did you come across? How did you end up in his, you know, in his purview?
Gosh, you know, I moved to Las Vegas. I think it was like 2001. I wanted to be a cocktail waitress. It was harder to get a cocktail waitress job than I thought, like at the good places. And so I was working as a waitress, and one of the regulars, this girl, Amy, came in and said, look, I think I know a professional gambler. Maybe I'm his masseuse. Maybe he'll hire you. And so I said, okay, that's good. That sounds great. And so I don't remember. Somebody called me the next day, and they're like, oh, come to this address, you know, tomorrow morning. And I drove, and it was like, you know, it was this really nice office park in, like, the suburbs of Las Vegas. And, and it was Dink's office. And so I just, you know, everything on the outside was so professional. You know, it was, like, divorce lawyers, and there was, like, a Coldwell Banker real estate place. And then there's this little mysterious office, you know, that doesn't have anything. I think it may have said Dink Inc. On the outside of it, but it was like a handmade sign or something. And of course, like, I walk in and it's just like, you know, bedlam the second like you step foot inside of this little office. And so I got hired. I didn't, you know, of course, like many of Dink's assistants, I had no experience whatsoever, and he actually preferred that, you know, he preferred to teach me his way. He could rest assured that I wasn't, like, you know, betting on a team. You know, like, you would hire some of these guy runners who are also gamblers, and they're going to the casinos and making bets for themselves as well as for him, and they're not rooting for the same team. And he was like, I'd rather not have that. It's perfect that you don't bet sports. It's perfect that you don't know anything. I will just influence you. And that's what he did.
This started when? Around 2000 you started?
Yeah, 2001. It was just after September 11th happened.
Wow. That's unbelievable. And how long were you in the job?
Well, it was I worked for Dink, and then, you know, he considered going offshore, and we went and we kind of did, like, a research trip to Costa Rica, and he was like, I don't think it's for me. I think I'm just going to stay a gambler in Las Vegas. You know, he liked his comforts. You know, Costa Rica is a little too, the offshore betting market, especially then, was very, like, over the top. So I ended up, I think I worked for him a total of, I don't know, 3 years, 2 or 3 years. And then I ended up going to graduate school at Columbia. And when I was there, I was writing, and I thought, you know, maybe I'll write about my time with Dink. And I remember calling him and saying, you know, what do you think of this idea? And he's like, oh, that's awful. Nobody wants to read this stuff. You know, this is very distasteful to a lot of people. And I was like, no, I think it's great. You know, but in, like, Columbia, it was like, you know, $45,000 a year or something. He's like, Beth, you cannot spend that kind of money to write, you know, something like this. And I'm like, no, I think it's great. I think it's, like, absolutely lovely. I think the world needs to hear about this milieu. And so I wrote the book.
Unbelievable. How, in terms of shopping the book, and I mean, it was your first experience, really, right, in doing something like
yes,
this?
Yes, I had never published anything, and so basically my professors at Columbia were very helpful. I mean, I remember I had a I took a profile class, you know, like when you write, you learn how to write profiles of people, like long form, like they have in the New Yorker. And one of my professors had been a writer at the New Yorker, and I wrote the profile on Dinky, and she was just blown away, and she's like, this is so good. He's such a rich character. He's so complex. He's so funny. And so my professors knew Dinky very well, and they were, you know, through my writing, and they helped me put together, I learned how to write a book proposal, and I got an agent, and then we shopped it to publishing houses.
That, of course, turns into a successful book, and then it gets shopped as a film prospect. Before we talk about the film and that transpiring, flesh out Alan and being around him, you know, virtually 24/7, because it's a 24/7 enterprise, really.
It really is. Yes, that's true. What was it like the day? Well, I think that's what I really set out to write about in Lay the Favorite. I really wanted to capture the day-to-day life of a professional gambler, especially a gambler who has had the life and history and upbringing and the challenges that Dinky had. I mean, being a bookmaker in New York City, getting arrested. He got a felony. He had to go to a halfway house in San Diego. He knew he couldn't be a bookmaker anymore. If he got caught, you know, making book again, he would have to really go to prison. And so he made the switch to bet with his own money. And I just wanted to show, like, all of that, his whole trajectory, what gamblers are up against politically, socially, economically, psychologically, emotionally, because he captured it all in, like, you know, one human being. So his day-to-day life, I mean, it was chaotic. It was a lot to handle. You're juggling a lot. You're responsible for a lot. You're responsible for getting the best numbers. You're responsible for people's livelihoods. You know, he did employ a true team. And just like anyone who manages a team, there's a lot of personalities. There's a lot of problems. He wore a lot of hats. And, of course, the stress. You know, we can talk about Dinky, and it's like, oh, and sometimes my book is like, called a joyride and stuff like that, but gamblers suffer. Gamblers who lose, yep. Gamblers who win. It doesn't matter. It's a lifestyle that you really have to contend with. It involves a lot of suffering. So did that answer your question?
it's part of the answer, and it also hints at the source, undoubtedly, of the illness that felled him. That kind of stress manifests itself in cancers. I mean, the ties are documented and well known that it would take back toll. Yeah, yeah.
It's totally true. And then when you have like the pandemic, Dinky was exceptional at creating a community for himself. As you listen, like on Twitter, we're hearing today with this tribute, he had so many friends. It was his talent to keep friendships alive and to make new friends throughout his life. But, you know, during the pandemic, first of all, gambling is a lonely endeavor. Sports gambling in particular, it's like writing. You're sitting in front of a computer by yourself, sweating out games from 7 in the morning until 11 at night. And, you know, usually when it wasn't the pandemic, he could go meet friends. He would go to the gym. He had, you know, but all of that closed down with the pandemic. So it made a kind of lonely endeavor even more lonely. And, you know, I think a lot of that, I think a lot of people experience that with the pandemic, certainly a lot of gamblers. it wasn't a fun time. So I do think there was an element of stress involved in all of this.
Undoubtedly. Beth Raymer is with us, the author of Lay the Favorite. First became the book and that she wrote after she had left Vegas. And then comes the movie. I mean, how quickly did Hollywood seize on the potential of Lay the Favorite to be made into a movie?
I mean, very quickly. I mean, immediately. I sold my book on proposal to Spiegel & Grau, which is a division of Random House. And there was someone at Random House whose job is to look at proposals and see if they're worthy of being looked at to be made into a film. And within days, my proposal when the film rights were bought. So I hadn't written the book yet. All I did was propose, wow. Hey guys, this is the book I want to write. And I sold it. And I also sold the movie rights. So they got, you know, by the time, I'm pretty sure the screenwriter finished the screenplay before I finished the book. So it's like we were just going neck to neck, you know, with like trying to get this out into the world as soon as possible so that it could be made into a movie.
Oh, that's amazing. So were you sending galleys along and...
I was sending my chapters as I finished them, so they were very raw. Yeah,
that's hysterical. Is that unusual, Beth, or is that done more often than we realize?
I really don't know. I don't know anyone else who had an experience like that, but I don't know that many writers. But it seems very unusual.
Well, I was going to say, and your whole involvement in this is unusual. I mean, it's like you were a bolt of lightning that made this happen, and it's just so kind of out of the blue to some extent. Were you happy, and was Alan happy with the movie?
I think the movie was, I think Dink had many feelings about both the book and the movie. I mean, to read about yourself in a book is seismic. There's nothing quite like it. And I think it was the first time Dink kind of saw or got a glimpse into how others saw him. I think it was the first time, you know, I really loved him, and that really came out, and I think even that, like, embarrassed him. I think you mentioned he's a humble guy. He doesn't like to be glorified, but in my eyes, he was worthy of glorification, and so I went with it. Even the things that were done in a generosity of spirit, he still, you know, struggled with. but I don't know. I think it was an incredibly fun time for us. I mean, Dink, when they were shooting the film, they shot the film in Las Vegas, New Orleans. Dink and Tulip Gale were on set. They were very much included. I know that I made some really great friends because of that film. I think they did too. I think he was okay with it.
Beth, what do you want people to know that I suppose that virtually everything may have been included already in the way you wrote about him, but. In retrospect, are there any parts of him and his personality that everyone should, you know, particularly appreciate? Because there were so many qualities to him and facets to, you know, the way he lived. But I, you know, you had as intimate a opportunity to you know, for this kind of an insight as anybody?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, I think, like others have mentioned, he was just an incredibly genuine person. Everyone knew where they stood with Zinke. If he was mad at you, he let you know it. If he was proud of you, he let you know it. He was just he asserted himself to his friends and to his very few, you know, enemies. You know, he would tell people off if they did others wrong or if they did him wrong. So I always appreciated and admired that. And then the other, you know, what I just loved about Zinke is he has this, you know, he was such a good son. He was so good to his mom. He does all of this amazing stuff for animals. Like, he had a special needs hamster. He gives all of this time and money to his horse organizations. But then there's also, like, I loved when he would introduce me, like, to touts and take me to, like, his old halfway house and talk about how he supported himself in the halfway house by going to Tijuana and betting, like, the Mexican sports market. So he just also had this slightly, I don't want to say a shady side. It wasn't anything like that, but he was not afraid to dabble in, like, darker corners of life. And I loved that about him. And he really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff.
Beth, I know this is tough, and I think everybody that was tracking this, I mean, that's one of the things about, you know, the finality of this week. The way in which he documented the illness, right from the hospital bed, in fact, and yeah, then there was this rally that you know made us all think, like, all right, Dink's gonna be around longer, and it's not gonna take him on the timing they suggested. I think everybody was just putting this off and facing the reality of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also happened very quickly.
Yeah.
When you get a cancer diagnosis, it's very, it's so shocking. And, what could be done? Dale was so caring. He had so many people caring for him, reaching out to him, being in touch with him. He felt supported, but, a cancer diagnosis is one of the worst things that can happen. So, it happened incredibly fast.
As mentioned, the Southern California Thoroughbred Rescue was the horse charity of choice for Dink, and any donation to an animal support organization will be appreciated by Alan and Beth. I appreciate this on the short timing to have you join us and really share what was more than a unique perspective.
Thank you for reaching out to me. And it actually feels very good to talk about him. Yesterday I was just scrolling through Twitter, reading everybody's messages on social media, and I don't really like Twitter, but it felt really good to just hear everyone's stories and everyone's little memories of him throughout his life. It was fun to talk to you.
Beth Raymer and Lay the Favorite, available at Goodreads and Amazon and anywhere else, and in sports sections of any bookstore, and of course on demand through the digital viewing, and Beth, I know there's going to be, I'm sure there's going to be fundraisers and any number of things that, that help everybody, you know, help Dink live on through, you know, people's appreciation of him. So I'm sure you'll be involved in plenty of those as well. So thanks so, so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Beth Raymer, and third of our four conversations, Jason Beam will join us, and we'll be able to really kind of carve out a special hour this morning. Paul Matisse and Dave Gutfriend ahead of Beth, and I'll put up a link for those that have never read the book, and I've got it on the shelf. It's one of those books that you just you know, you can actually go back to and pick up, and it's just funny and warm and crazy, and it's funny. It's one thing to read about Dink in that regard, but it's very different, you know, when you actually see him, and that's why my impression of him is the one that I got to see, you know. And of course, it's restaurants and bars in Vegas and at Treasure Island a lot, in the backyard at Saratoga. I mean, that's my, you know, that's, you know, my exposure over the last 10 plus years, and I found him just, you know, kind of mirthful and quiet, and then being able to follow him on Twitter, you know, these last several years, and the fundraiser, you know, which we had him talk about when he visited us on the NHC show. Yeah, well. Jason standing by because he just texted me a couple of minutes ago, and he had been, at first he thought we were going to reach him in the grocery store, and then in the parking lot, and then, no, it's just the way things spun out, as it turned out. But, you know, Jason, and I'm going to anticipate that, you know, part of Jason's exposure and getting to know Dink came from his own writing and when he put together Southbound as well. I'm sure that that's part of, you know, what led him to Dink. But you know, you're getting, you know, all kinds of nice references and insights. The you know, to Dink as a mentor, to, you know, as somebody who wanted to, you know, do good, essentially. Jason Beam, standing by with us now. Jason, good morning, and I know how close you got to. The Dink. So sorry.
Steve, I appreciate you having me on. Yeah, it was a sad day yesterday. I talked to a couple of his best friends recently that had been out visiting him, and, you know, they'd said he was doing all right, and so kind of thought it was going to, you know, have a little more time, but yeah, it is what it is, I guess.
I pretty much have asked everybody this morning their first, you know, crossing paths, and whether it was organic or seeking him out, knowing, you know, have an infectious curiosity about players and about gaming. Did you reach out to meet Alan, or how did you guys come across?
We met at NHC, actually. We had followed each other on Twitter, so we kind of knew of each other, but hadn't met. I didn't know kind of the legend of Dink when I met him. I knew he was a professional gambler, but I didn't, you know kind of all the backstories and the movies and books and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I met him at the Orleans. So maybe it was back. It was, what was the one that used to be at the Orleans, not the
World Series,
the Horse Player World Series. That was where I met him at, because I remember seeing him walk in. You know, he had that monster pompadour haircut, and
yes.
he was completely impossible to miss. He was a big guy too, and so I saw him walking in, and I said, "Alan," and you know, and he said, "Yeah," you know, because. But one of my favorite things about Dink is he had like the most unique voice, and the way I describe it was he used to speak very bashfully. You know, like he would speak on topics that he was an expert at and a professional at, but he would almost do it in like such a tender way that it was, yep. you know, there was some nerves mixed in there and stuff. But yeah, that was the first time I met him, and then obviously met him again at NHC. And I lived in Las Vegas for just a real, real short period of time, and so, you know, got to visit with him then and just kind of stayed friends. Been fortunate to sit at a few NHL games with him, a couple Golden Knights games, and last year he came down to Tampa for a week. Actually, it wasn't even last year, it was this year. It was maybe a week or two before Tampa Bay Derby, and you know, him and his friend came out to the races a couple days in a row, and we went to the game, and he had said that he wasn't feeling well, and he was, you know, walking a little gingerly, and he thought he had a hernia, and it was when he got, because he was out looking to move to Florida, and when he got back home, that was when he got checked out and found out that he had the cancer. And so that was actually the last time I saw him. I talked to him, you know, throughout the months recently, and maybe, I guess, probably 2 months ago, I guess, would have been the last time I spoke to him.
What stood out for you? I mean, he is a person, as everybody's heard this morning from, you know, Paul Matisse and David Goodfriend and Beth Raymer, somebody that people were drawn to. I thought that Paul's characterization really kind of spoke to that. You just felt. You know, you were just intrigued. For me, that was the case. But I suppose part of that was his, you know, knowing that he was this larger than life gambler character.
Yeah, I mean, the character was the word that kept coming to mind for me. Like, he was just a truly unique character, right? There were so many parts of him physically and personality wise that were just very unique. And you know, his speaking about kind of the, I thought he thrived off of the social aspect of things, about concerts and wrestling shows and horse racing and stuff like that. And, you know, when the pandemic hit, we had started a group Zoom chat, and Leo Vukmanovich, who I'm assuming you know Leo, but...
Of course.
Leo and was talking to Dink, and Dink was saying, you know, that he was really struggling early on in the pandemic just because he was not getting any real social time. And so they started a little chat with, you know, those two and a couple other professional better types down in Nevada and elsewhere. And I was at it a week or two later, and, you know, Candace Hare was at it after that. And the 6-7 of us, we did those chats for like the first 90 days of the pandemic. Every night at like 7 o'clock, we would all get together on there and just talk about whatever we were talking about. And, you know, when Remington Quarters would start up, you know, everybody would start playing and betting. But, you know, we covered almost every topic there was in those 90 days. And we, you know, after that, we shortened it down to 2 or 3 days a week. And we still do it every Thursday night. Obviously, Dink hasn't participated in quite a while. But, you know, we're going to do it tonight and then talk about him then. But it was, you know, I really do think that was something that he thrived on and craved, was that social aspect of things. And I think that speaks part of why he had so many friends. I think what you and Paul mentioned about his uniqueness was another reason that he attracted a lot of people to him. But I think he thought that out as I think he really valued connections with people. And he was pretty good about fostering those. You know, he would, like, for me at least, he would send me notes right. all the time. You know, when he'd hear a race, say nice things about my announcing or that he was proud of me. And, you know, just little stuff like that.
Yeah. What did you come to learn from him about gambling?
That was one of the cool things about going to the hockey games with him was, you know, hockey's kind of become my second favorite sport now behind racing, and I've really just got into it probably the last 4 to 5 years. And listening to him talk about how he would watch a game as a bettor and you know, tell me what goal, you know, if these guys score, it's really good for the over. If the other guys score, it's terrible for the over. And I'm like, but it's still one goal. He's like, no. And he would explain, you know, the difference about how, you know, because then if these guys score, now it's a tie game and it's forced to get another goal. And just little things that you wouldn't, or, you know, that as a novice you wouldn't look out for. And it's, you know, it's the same in racing, right? I mean, we're all kind of taught the basics, but when you really kind of learn from someone sharp, you see a lot of really unique different angles that you just wouldn't unless you were kind of told them, learned them, or, you know, spent years kind of learning them yourself, I guess. But for me, with betting with Alan, like, that was the real cool thing to see. You know, you sit and realize, like, this guy's made his living betting hockey for 40 years. Like, he's got a pretty good opinion. And he was very self-aware in recent years about kind of how much the field had caught up to him, too, just with all the technology, the numbers, and the smart people and computers. And, you know, he never kind of converted to that, you know, methodology of betting. And so, you know, he was very aware about how much that gap had closed, and it was tough for him. And he would talk a lot about, oh, maybe I just need to retire and stop, and da, da, da. And then that was part of his personality, too, right? Like, he got down to himself very easily. And, you know, he was one of the last, I feel like, pro bettors that, like, sweated every game, too. I mean, I remember going to dinner with him, and, you know, it was November, I guess. I mean, he was getting, like, college basketball scores to his pager and checking ESPN.com, you know, and none of these bets were going to, you know, affect his day-to-day life that much, but, I mean, he was always sweating them. And so many of these modern players now, I mean, they don't watch the games because they don't need to. All their information is on the computer, you know, it takes away a lot of that emotion, but I think things like the emotion of it, like, you know, even though it maybe stressed him out a little bit.
Well, that's an interesting take too, Jason, because dedicated horse players, we've got the same exact refrain, really, that it's gotten harder, you know, and it was already hard just based on takeout and you know, the cost of bets, but then, you know, you fold in the market is, you know, smarter and smarter. There's more information that had only previously been in the hands of you know, people who went out of their way and had the extra mile, you know, whether it was on site, having their own on site workout coverage, or, you know, all the different form that takes, you know, the speed figures and everything else. I mean, the proliferation of all these pieces of information. And,
video replay. And I mean, there's guys that used to...
Video replay.
Video replay. Those guys used to, you know, stay up to 11 o'clock to tape the half-hour replay show, so they had access to the replays, because, you know, other than that was your shot. Now we just dial up to Inspires and fire right up. Quick plug.
Good job. Well, he's going to be terribly missed, and Jason, we've got. I think one message came through with this last hour, and that is that there's going to be ways to honor his memory and keep it alive. So that'll be, you know, that'll be part of the aftermath here. But in the short term, we've brought up the Southern California Thoroughbred Rescue, which was his aftercare team of choice. So if you want to pay tribute to Alan that way, and there'll be others as well. And well, I appreciate this, Jace.
No, I appreciate you having me on. I mean, he was just such a sweet man, and I loved that. A lot of his, you know, colleagues and friends like Paul and like the Maven and Beth and stuff have been able to speak on his behalf, because I think, like I said, you could probably find 30 people, and the fact that even I got to share some memories is greatly appreciated by me.
Jason Beam, everybody, Beamy Awards on Twitter, of course, and Colonial Season getting into the later stages, and some big racing yet to come. We'll maybe talk about that, Jason, next week.
Yeah, Virginia Derby's Tuesday, closing day Wednesday.
Jason Beam, everybody, as we pay tribute to Alan Dinkinson, Dinky, gone at 69, and that basically robs everybody. I want to thank Paul Matisse and David Goodfriend, Beth Raymer, and Jason. Let's take a break and come back for hour three. Sean Clancy in next, and we'll probably look at the last jump race with Sean, but probably going to also reprise our discussion that we had on TV with him on Sunday. It's been a very unique and difficult summer season for Sean. The barn fire on his property back home, and the toll it took on him. Sean Clancy, when we come back at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Thoroughbred horse racing is back in Virginia as Colonial Downs conducts its More Racing, More Money summer season presented by Woodford Reserve. An early week racing schedule and average daily purses of $625,000. The 9-week meet runs from July 11th through September 7th with racing every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m. Wager on Colonial's 50-cent pick 5 with a low 12% takeout and a new carryover provision. All races will be broadcast on TVG this summer. Colonial Downs racing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? The University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.